Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This next Sunday, July 14th, is the 230th anniversary of Bastille Day, which is France's Independence Day, 13 years and 10 days after our own. You surely remember when the revolutionary French peasants, led by Joan of Arc and the three musketeers, D'Artagnan, Napoleon, and Robespierre, stormed the Bastille and liberated Paris, including the Eiffel Tower, which had not been built yet. Unfortunately, the Notre Dame Cathedral was lost to a napalm attack by King Pepin the Simple's airborne tanker force, led by France's arch-traitor, Pierre Laval. Of course, there is an alternate history, which I will start today's program with. It was written by Catherine Bridget Snow, who was KMUN's second program director, to commemorate Bastille Day's bicentennial in 1989. Liberty and the Bastille by Catherine Bridget Snow. If you stand at night in the center of Paris's golden-lit bridge, La Pointe de la Concorde, and face roughly west, you will see to the right La Tour Eiffel, its graceful lines and small lights against a dark blue sky. To the left is the Cathedral de Notre Dame, sitting quietly at a bend in the slow river, looking small in the distance. It's not far from the cathedral to where you stand perhaps a 30-minute walk, past the Palace of Justice, past the Louvre Museum where one king used to hunt on horseback down the long halls through the Garden of the Tuileries to the Place de la Concorde. The Place de la Concorde is a whirlpool of cars, four deep, swirling all around a tall monument at the center, then streaming down the Seine or up to the Champs-Élysées. The U.S. Embassy is just on the other side of the place, as are the fine leather, glove, and handbag shops. This is what you would see as an American visitor to the city. If, however, you were a Parisian factory worker in the summer of 1789, you might have tread those 30 minutes from the Hôtel de Ville behind Notre Dame to Les Invalides between the Pointe de la Concorde and taken one of the 32,000 muskets stored there to defend yourself against the king's troops rumored to be surrounding Paris. And if you were a woman a few years later, you might have sat with Dickens' Madame Defarge in the Place de la Concorde near the guillotine and knitted as tumbril after tumbril rolled past, carrying aristocracy to be beheaded. Tradition has it that the French Revolution began with the storming of the Bastille in a peasant's revolt against aristocratic power, the 14th of July, 1789. But the crowd's original intent was not to free prisoners. It was to demand ammunition to protect people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine, towards whom the Bastille cannon was pointed. There had been minor riots for 3 days over the state of the Parliamentary Assembly at Versailles, and Parisians feared more violence from the aristocracy and military. The people at Faubourg Saint-Antoine feared cannon fire from the Bastille to the west and an imminent attack from some 300,000 troops rumored to be coming from the east. There were only 7 prisoners in the Bastille on July 14, 1789, none political prisoners. The fortress had long been used only for discreet imprisonment of the wealthy or influential. While it still represented despotism for the workers, few, if any, of the thousands amassing outside it that day were in a position to know who might be inside the fortress. The government had been unsteady for some time, but the balance of power tipped discernibly toward the assembly in mid-June when King Louis XVI ordered the Parliamentary Assembly, the Third Estate, to dissolve, and they refused. The king stopped just short of using military force. Instead, on July 11th, Louis sent the director of finance, Necker, into exile. Bankers and shopkeepers who had looked to Necker's fiscal policies to restore a sound economy protested and marched up the Champs-Élysées into skirmishes with the king's soldiers. Communications with the court at Versailles were cut off July 13th. Rumors flew that the king's troops were surrounding the city, strengthened with large groups of brigands, the outlaws who destroyed crops from village to town and survived through smuggling and violence. Parisians made the trek to the Bastille on the 14th for ammunition and self-defense. They did not know that the governor inside the fortress, Delaunay, had no provisions, no orders from Versailles, an ineffective cannon, and a garrison of mostly aged soldiers who did not want to open fire at the people. Negotiations between Delaunay and members of the bourgeoisie began amicably until each side, misinterpreting the other, thought it was under attack. Crowds pushed across the drawbridge. Most of the garrison escaped, and the rest were killed. Delaunay made it as far as the Hotel de Ville before his head was speared to parade around the city. It was the beginning of a violence that would escalate in 3 years to the Reign of Terror, the bloody extermination of the aristocracy, romanticized in A Tale of Two Cities and The Scarlet Pimpernel. It is controversial whether or not the economy played a large role in the Revolution of 1789. The price of grain had been the source of unrest and riots in the provinces since early that year. Relaxed export laws had pulled much of the grain from storage, and the harvest of 1788 was poor. Bread prices doubled in Paris and quadrupled in the provinces. Vintners were especially hard hit, since the grape harvest had been abnormally good, driving down the price of wine. The aristocracy was suspected of a conspiracy to hoard grain and keep the price up. The brigands, terrorizing the countryside, were suspected of being in the pay of the aristocracy. However, it was Necker's dismissal that provided the people of Paris with a concrete reason for massive protest. Necker had a name for reform and sound finance, and had been disagreement over specific economic proposals which put the very existence of the assembly in question. Paris was on edge over the threats to the Third Estate and the rumored looming massacre by government troops and brigands. Necker's exile was the outrage that began the riots. In the provinces, word of the Paris riots spread, and peasants attacked the chateau, destroying records of credit and debt. Their own revolt was not a direct protest of events at Versailles. They had distrusted Necker for supposed deals with grain millers, which benefited landowners. The peasants were starving, they were penniless, and they were afraid of the traveling brigands. As the struggle continued between the king and the increasingly powerful National Assembly and the various interests of the bourgeoisie and the working class, the food shortage did not abate. By October, the aristocracy had all exited to Versailles, and the Parisians pushed for Louis's return to Paris as a solution to the unrest and economic crises. He returned in early October to the Louvre, and the assembly followed, installing itself in the Tuileries on November 9th. In the ensuing struggle for power between the king and the assembly, the king gradually lost his sovereign rule. Few people would have foreseen the coming terror, when the guillotine would reign sovereign over the bloody Place de la Concorde. The Tuileries are just east of the Place de la Concorde, with well-groomed trees planted in even squares and long straight paths which stretch to the Louvre. Walking north across to Place de la Concorde, you can turn and walk through the long gardens towards the lights of the Louvre beyond, or you could meander up the Champs-Élysées, admiring the fur coats and the pet poodles which parade up and down the boulevard. Either way you turn, you will walk through the Place de la Concorde. History is alive in Paris. The passion is embedded in the streets. As you walk through the place, it takes only a little concentration to imagine the streets sticky with blood and yourself pressed into the crowd, standing before the guillotine. And that was by Catherine Bridget Snow, Liberty and the Bastille. And now, the first of two Bloody Thursdays. This one is simply called Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike, which I wrote. 85 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934 when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter pitched battles with guns, gas, and clubs, arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of shipowners, presidents of stevedoring companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 71st anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4th holiday provided a truce, and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m., promptly, the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines, and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted a newspaper. The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that the workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. A San Francisco Chronicle reporter described, women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls. Smothered and blinded by gas, the women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriman had said earlier. You refuse to arbitrate. Now take the consequences. Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois, or Bourdois, how do you want to pronounce it. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast the length of Market Street behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads. Overhead, a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. another newspaper, said that the two dead strikers in life would not have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes in union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed, and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions, and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast's maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever, the Great Maritime Strike of 1936. The Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, which later became affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, becoming the AFL-CIO. And it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that on every July 5th there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it and 2 years after his death at 41. Therefore, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act, Quinn wrote. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority, other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, by the consent of the governed. And that was Mike Quinn. And now, the second Bloody Thursday, the Battle for People's Park, Berkeley, 1969, when Vietnam came home, by Clara Bingham, and she wrote this for the Guardian newspaper. In May 1970, the Ohio National Guard shot at hundreds of students protesting against the invasion of Cambodia, wounding 8 and killing 4. Kent State was seared into the national consciousness. The U.S. government had authorized the killing of its own white children. But what many might not know is that a year earlier, in Berkeley, California, police opened fire with buck and birdshot on a large crowd of young protesters seeking to keep open People's Park, an impromptu community garden on land University of California at Berkeley wanted to use. 50 people were hit. James Rector, a 25-year-old visitor from San Jose, was killed. Alan Blanchard was blinded. Donovan Rundle was shot point-blank in the stomach and almost bled to death. After almost 2 dozen surgeries, he would live with chronic pain for the next 50 years. Bloody Thursday, 15 May 1969, was the day the Vietnam War came home. The streets of Bohemian Berkeley, the New Left's West Coast HQ, became a bloody war zone. Martial law was declared, a curfew imposed, and National Guardsmen with unsheathed bayonets and live ammunition occupied the town. A military helicopter doused the campus with tear gas. Many members of the Alameda County Sheriff's Department had just come home from Vietnam. Some later admitted that they treated anti-war students like Viet Cong. This pivotal event in 1960s history comes back to life in an excellent new oral history, The Battle for People's Park, Berkeley, 1969, by Tom Dalzell. The book recounts the chaotic 40 days and nights from 20 April to 30 May 1969 with detail that reads like a gut punch. People's Park evokes haunting memories of Kent State. Republican governors in California and Ohio were running re-election campaigns and rallying their base by demonizing the student movement. The chancellors of UC Berkeley and Kent State were out of town on the days of the shootings, contributing to disorder, handing law enforcement greater rein. In his foreword to People's Park, Tom Gitlin explains that California's governor, Ronald Reagan, ran his 1966 campaign on making welfare bums, and that's a quote, go back to work and cleaning up the mess in Berkeley, which is also a quote. By the time he was running for re-election, he had all but granted the National Guard and law enforcement officers permission to shoot to kill. If it takes a bloodbath, let's get it over with. No more appeasement, Reagan said. Describing campus protesters a year later, the Ohio governor, James Rhodes, echoed Reagan, Richard Nixon, and Spiro Agnew. They're worse than the brown shirts and the communist elements. They're the worst types of people we harbor in America. The stories Dalzell elicits from Berkeley shooting victims are eerily similar to stories Kent State victims told me when I interviewed them for my own oral history, Witness to the Revolution. Donovan Rundle told Dalzell the chilling story of being singled out by a shotgun-toting Alameda County Sheriff's deputy. He gave no prior warning of any sort, nor any order to move on. It felt like I'd been hit in the gut with a sledgehammer. The buckshot used on me was packed in a 12-gauge shell that holds 9 double-aught pellets. Each is about the size of a .32 caliber bullet. I was shot in the gut with 5 or 6 of these. Dean Collar, who has spent 49 years in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down after being shot on the Kent State campus by the Ohio National Guard, told me, I was in the practice football field when they turned and lowered their weapons. I thought, oh my God, they're going to shoot. I looked around, and there was no place to hide. Reminding us how deeply divided the country was in 1969, Rundle recounts being carried into an ambulance when someone heard a bystander say, I hope you die, you effing hippie. Collar, who, like Rundle, spent months in the hospital fighting for his life, remembers the opening a greeting card that read, Dear Communist Hippie, Radical, I hope by the time you read this, you are dead. The police and National Guard claimed they shot in self-defense. The governors of Ohio and California smeared the unarmed victims. Not one member of law enforcement was convicted of a crime. So much for white exceptionalism. People's Park was one square block of turf with a swing set and poetry stand, but it represented much more than the hippie playground political leaders chose to call it. It stood for the social and political aspirations of a generation. As Steve Wasserman writes in his afterword to People's Park, the stark and brutal smashing of our hopes was a hammer blow. And that was The Battle for People's Park, Berkeley, 1969. And it was by Clara Bingham, who is the author of Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. And she wrote this for the Guardian, the U.S. Edition. And now, something I wrote quite a number of years ago, inspired by this season's multiple anniversaries of protest and revolt against domestic tyranny and oppression. Perhaps you have witnessed or are made aware of a monstrous injustice and feel you must fight it. Opening your eyes and minds to a lot of truths hidden from you is not an easy thing to do. First, you want to retreat back to where you had been. It was easier there. Everything was worked out for you without you having to do a thing. But if you have left, you can't go back. It isn't the same anymore. The questions still nag, and you can't get rid of them. Finally, no more place to hide. You begin to move, horror pulling at you with each new glimmer of the real reality. People starving on the edges of prosperity. Fat cats gross in their gluttony. Black people pushed up against walls. Indians boozing it too heavy because that's all there is for them except suicide. Chicanos breaking their backs and wearing out their hands, grubbing for potatoes and lettuce in broiling fields. Coal miners owned lock, stock, and barrel by the company and dying young of black lung. The broken parade of missing arms and legs passing by on their way home from war to rejection and oblivion. You've learned to see, and you know the games people play with your mind to keep you blind. The first thing you become is a liberal, which essentially derives from liberty. Unwilling to fully throw off your lifelong indoctrination you think of as beliefs, you write letters to your president and Congress people and to your local newspaper. Most of the time you don't get any answers, and the newspaper neglects to print your letters. You find a liberal candidate. She or he says great things, going to end the war, work for equal opportunities, won't make too many concessions unless elected. If honest, she or he loses with little chance, and you are possibly called unpatriotic or worse, a liberal, if you campaign for her or him. After a couple of these type of experiences, you are no longer a liberal. Pretty soon you get involved in political demonstrations. Everything you tried before ended in frustration. The politicians tell you to attempt reform and change through the system, so you take them at their word, and they slam the door in your face. No place left but the streets. Take away all the self-righteous mysticism, and you realize that's where Jesus took his revolution, in the streets, with the street people, the dirges of society. Cops are all over the place with cameras, getting your face on the files they keep on people like you. Helicopters fly over, low and hovering. You see buses loaded with cops parked and waiting. Other cops surround you, grasping long sticks, their belts packed with associated tear gases and mace containers, gas masks hanging ready, hard hats firmly buckled with chin straps, their toes, torsos, and perhaps even legs encased in body armor. You know there are provocateurs around, some from the police waiting to get things started, others thinking they are right-on revolutionaries, ready to radicalize you and everybody else through the recruiting system of busted heads. You start walking, a little tense, trying to relax and smile at everybody smiling at you. You're all in this together, lonely and afraid, fleas challenging elephants. Chants are started, then singing, hundreds of voices rebounding off the walls of buildings, filling the streets with beauty and defiance. The songs are prayers, really, for peace and love. Suddenly, within a heartbeat, peace receives its usual bloody nose. The cops are coming in, gas masked and swinging. You begin to choke and your eyes sting. You can't see and you can't breathe. Panic convulses you for a moment. You force it down. The only thing you can do is put a handkerchief against your face and wait until you can get some water. You hear screams and people begin running past you. Somebody pulls at your arm, urging you to flee. It's too late. A cop has you in his sights. He's coming at you, club poised over his head. You can't run. He's on you, and you scream with the pain shooting through your head or shoulders, your entire body. You're on the ground. Your hands are covering your head, and they are bleeding. You want to vomit. The cop keeps hitting you in the head, the back, the stomach. Whichever way you twist, you can't get away from him. He's still hitting you. Then he's gone. You look for him, afraid he will come back. You're dazed. Blood pours from your head. Some of your knuckles are smashed. Your ribs and back are on fire. You look around. A lot of other people are down and hurt. A young woman lies near you, unconscious. You hear crying and wonder if you're also crying. Medics, not the regular official kind, risk their necks like combat medics in a war to get the hurt bodies who need their aid. They dodge cops who consider them fair game. one of them gets to you and helps you to your feet and gets you out of there to an emergency medical station set up on the spot when the cops attack. A lot of people are being bandaged up, children even. The noises seem far away, even the whimperings of the badly hurt who await hospitalization but are shielded from arrest. You wonder if anybody is dead. Later, you watch it on television and read about it in the newspapers. It isn't the same. The paper and TV say the police were provoked by radical hoodlums. That just wasn't true. But then you've got over-expecting truth. So where do you go from there? Do you get really radical, pick up a gun or a bomb? Do you go back out into the street again and again and again? Or do you wait for the right moment and a new method of effective protest? And that was something I wrote, as I said, quite a few years ago. And this is Michael McCusker. 135 years ago, on July 4th, 1884, France presented the United States with the Statue of Liberty to commemorate the French and American revolutions. And lest we forget Emma Lazarus's passionately poetical inscription on Liberty's pedestal, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, the tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." 4 days later, on July 8, 1884, the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children was founded in the USA. And today, July 11, 1807, U.S. Vice President Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in the most famous American duel. Happy Bastille Day.